Okay, well, I might kick off just to save some time. In case you're thinking you're at the wrong session, there's been a slight change of title, so this session is now called Potential Regulatory Changes in Response to AASB 17. So if you're looking for the VFA session, this is it. So I'll just very quickly introduce the three speakers this afternoon. They are Belen Cummings, Grant Robinson and Chris Schuber. So very quickly, Belen is a partner with KPMG's actuarial and financial risk practice. She is a qualified actuary with over 20 years experience specialising in the insurance and wealth management area, and has spent the last 2 years working with companies implementing IFRS 17 across the Asia Pacific region. Grant is a senior actuary on AMP's IFRS 17 project. Prior to this, Grant headed up AMP's actuarial systems and process team. He is currently a member of the AASB's Insurance Transition Resource Group and the Actuaries Institute's AASB 17 Implementation Task Force. He has been involved in development of the IFRS insurance standard since 2007. When not actively involved with the new insurance standard through work and participation in the International Actuarial Association's Insurance Standard Committee, drafting groups, and the AASB 17 Insurance Task Force, bit of a mouthful, he relaxes, you'd be pleased to know, by trying to catch fish from his sailing kayak. Lastly, Chris Schuber is an actuary with over 10 years' experience in the life insurance industry, and he's currently the head of actuarial capital and risk management at MLC. Chris is leading the AASB 17 project at MLC to understand the implications of AASB 17 on MLC, the many potential interpretations and the work involved to implement the new accounting standard. He is also active within the profession, both as a member of the Institute's Life Financial Reporting Subcommittee and an active contributor to three of the AASB 17 Task Force working projects. He is undertaking this presentation to provide a constructive view regarding APRA's response to AASB 17 to assist them to continue their robust potential oversight of the life insurers without significantly adding to regulatory requirements, reporting requirements. Sounds a bit sucky, but anyway, we'll see. Just a reminder, they'll be taking questions basically as they go. So rather than leaving it to the end, they'll be taking questions as they go. But just a reminder that if you do want to ask a question, can you please speak into the microphone, because all of this, all of the sessions will be recorded for posterity. So please speak into the microphone if you have a question. I'll hand it over to Bjorn.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for the introduction, David. So when we sort of started this back, when we all had to put in our topics, we knew we wanted to do something about the variable fee approach. We weren't quite sure what, and so we had sort of a topic title in there. We then refined it down to being, well, the main problem that we actually wanted to address was how do you align the variable fee approach with the requirements in the Life Act and APRA's rules and regulations. And then we got about halfway through that and we thought, why would we just stop with the variable fee approach? Why wouldn't we just address the whole topic of the issues of how you align AASB 17 with APRA, at which point we end up with a completely different title, which is Potential Regulatory Changes. So that's sort of how you get from the topic in the handout there to what we're actually talking about today. I do want to emphasise, simply because AASB 17 and IFRS 17 are amongst some intellectual circles very hotly debated topics with lots of controversy, that the views today are all our own views and not necessarily those of our employers, and they're not necessarily the views shared by all of us here either, in terms of the three of us. So they are definitely somebody's views at some point in time. Okay. So AASB 17 is complex, and in Australia we have a large number of other regulations which it would be nice for it to all happily coexist with. To date, we've largely as an industry said to APRA, well, what are you going to do? However, as proactive rather than reactive people and aware that a lot of the information that's needed to make the decisions as to what APRA should do, some of that information is potentially sitting out in the insurance community rather than sitting with APRA. And so Grant, Chris and I set ourselves a challenge of saying, well, if we were to put ourselves in APRA's shoes, what would we do? I think that we would probably describe where we've got to and what we're presenting today as a work in progress rather than a definitive answer. As such, we're intending to run this session in an interactive manner, so we'll seek your feedback along the way rather than waiting until the end. And at the end, we're interested in your views as to what the next step should be or how this work should be taken forward. So without further ado, we'll start and invite you to spend the next 40 minutes walking with us in APRA's shoes. The current landscape. So as we all know, the Life Act was introduced in 1995, and at that time, a board was established called the Life Insurance Actuarial Standards Board. This board was formed with a combination of auditors and actuaries, or accountants and actuaries, but it was formed with industry practitioners. The LISB issued the first MOS valuation standard in October 1996, and it was applied from 31 December 96. And AASB 1038, which was issued in November 1998 and applied from 31 December 1999, largely leveraged off what the LISB had already done. It was developed as a package. It was developed for the Australian market, and it was driven by the actuarial profession. Therefore, it is not unreasonable to say it was designed specifically for us, and therefore it worked about as well as you could possibly think something might work in that sort of environment. This all changes with AASB 17. So AASB 17, all the detail that you need to understand the standard is in AASB 17. So in AASB 1038, if you've ever read it, it doesn't say very much. So all the detail about how you actually do the valuation is actually in the actuarial standard. Whereas in AASB 17, all the detail is within AASB 17. You don't need to go looking for external sources of information. Therefore, the need to align financial and regulatory reporting is now a question as to will APRA continue on with what they currently have, or will they now align with what's in AASB 17, because they don't need to provide an extra layer of detail on top anymore. And AASB 17 obviously applies for all reporting periods commencing from 1 January 2021. We decided in our walk through APRA's shoes, we thought we should start with establishing a set of principles that would support our thinking. Our key objective, if we were APRA, is obviously the solvency and the reporting of solvency at both an entity and a statutory fund level. Our second objective is participating profits and making sure that the 80-20 or 90-10 or whatever the relevant ratio is for your company is maintained, and ensuring that the pattern of shareholder release does not expose policyholders to undue risk. The third element that we thought that APRA might have is that of comparability, the need to be able to compare and contrast different companies' balance sheets and P&L. And finally, we gave ourselves a principle of limiting the unnecessary reporting burden. And what did we mean by that? So we thought it depends upon where you start. So what we thought is if we were in APRA, we'd like to start with AASB 17. And then you'd say, well, in order to achieve my other objectives, how much do I have to change? So what are the state changes that I would need to make to AASB 17 in order to achieve my objectives? This contrasts with the situation where you might start with the current accounting process, MOS, and you might say, well, how many of these AASB 17 changes can I incorporate into MOS in order that I kind of reach a partway point? So it's very important when we think about this limit unnecessary burden. To us, that meant you start with the new system and then you say, how much do I need to change, rather than start with the existing system and say, how far can I go forward? Because when you have a status quo, it's always very tempting just to kind of retain as much of it as you can. So at this point, I sort of want to ask my first question, which is, are there any other principles you think we should be included? Do you disagree with any of the principles that we have? Do you think any of them should change, be expanded? Views? Yes. Could you speak into the microphone, please?
I was just wondering, issue number one is very one-sided, or principle number one. If they're compromised by a lower level of risk, what happens if IFRS 17 gives them a higher level of solvency requirements, etc. Shouldn't one of the principles be maintain the current rather than just worry about excessive?
I think that's what we meant when we said it. We were thinking that the current level of solvency should be maintained. There was in our minds the thought that it should increase or reduce. I think it was maintain. Were there any other comments? If I had a show of hands, how many people kind of agree that those are the right principles? Excellent. We're off to a fantastic start. Okay. So those are the principles, and those are the views by which we're now going to be assessing the various items in AASB 17 and how they might differ from current regulatory requirements. We'll be taking them back to those principles to say, well, they differ, but does it violate any of those principles? So without further ado, I'll hand over to Grant. Thank you.
Thanks, Briella. And the good news for those who thought this was a VFA section, this is the VFA part of the session. So the variable fee approach, and basically you're thinking about what might APRA's focus be. So if you look at, for example, the big pieces are really the PAR business, PAR conventional, PAR investment account, individual and group, and stuff there. What do we think APRA's focus should be? Well, clearly, profit share outcomes, so effectively the policyholders really get the cash flows that they're currently expecting to come out of the Life Act and the current regulatory framework and the way things work. And suddenly money hasn't moved across to the shareholders, because I'm pretty sure the shareholders were working hard to make sure money doesn't move across to the policyholders out of this exercise. The PAR retained profit splits 80-20, that's a bit of a question mark in my mind, so long as effectively you get the right share going to the policyholders, as opposed to having a nice balance sheet you've got on IFRS and current MOS accounting, where you see the two side by side. No change to ultimately. And then ultimately the other one is solvency and capital, which ultimately jeopardises that expected cash flow to policyholders. Is anybody comfortable that's the right framework for PAR business to look at it? Nobody disagrees? No?
I've got a smart question.
Yeah.
Is the
definition of profit between AASB 17 and what APRA considers in terms of working out the 80-20 split, is the definition of profit the same?
It's clearly different because effectively there is no policyholder profit under IFRS 17 of itself. So the question is then, if you're going to keep IFRS 17 or AASB 17 as your starting point, how do you make sure that you actually still get the right amount going to the policyholder? But whether you actually need a notional accounting profit to do that is a separate question. And then investment linked with insurance riders, I think really that one is really about solvency and capital, and there is a question later about how you do the unbundling, given the accounting does treat the thing as one into separate step funds. But it doesn't. I don't think there's any different there. This is a diagram, which I think will be familiar to a few people, from research from the MLC. This is very kindly plagiarised from one that Chris provided us, and they're thinking they don't work in that, and I've just reshaped it, so any misrepresentation is my work. But basically what I try to bring through is effectively, on the left-hand side, you've kind of got the MOS, the Life Act, and really got a best estimate liability, which is your guarantees. We haven't unpacked there whether you're doing that at a risk-free rate or whether you're doing it at a MOS net earned rate, but then you've got your profit margin, your PRP, and that's just what's effectively going to the policyholders in the future out of this process. And then under the Life Act, you've got your balancing, which is your future SRP and your present value profit margins. And that's where the 80-20 split kind of needs to be maintained in terms of what flows to which. And then over on the right, if you've got your AASB 17 representation of the same thing. I appreciate it. Maybe a little hard to see from the back, but you're welcome to come forward and ask questions as well. And effectively, you've got your best estimate liability guarantees. Your re-evaluation shouldn't really change. Your policyholder bonuses and your two sections, which come out of your PRP and your MOS piece. Then you've got a CSM, which is what you now have got a different timing thing, and that's the profit recognition to policy shareholder. You've got a risk adjustment, which comes out of the policy shareholder's profit margin. There's no risk adjustment on the policyholder side. And then effectively you've got what's currently recognised, and that piece will be different as well. So that's kind of how the two sit together. And then you're trying to think out, how do you actually use the building blocks on the right to maintain the important things on the left? And that's what we were trying to work our way through ourselves. And so you got, these are kind of the differences in this, our thinking around how you might address some of the differences. You've got policyholder profits, there isn't any. No profit split. So one way, which is basically that previous diagram kind of illustrates, is to treat the unvested bonuses as effectively the policyholder bonuses. So effectively, you've got the guarantee, anything above that, that's obviously going to the policyholders, whether it's inside your VSA and MOS at the moment or your PRP, which is really about how you originally set up your MOS transition, you just treat that as, that's ultimately your policyholder discretionary flow, and get that balance of what goes to shareholders. The release on supportable bonuses, that's how MOS does it. You now have got a release, thanks to their recent one and only announced plan change to IFRS 17, which is to allow VFA to use investment service as well as insurance. Well, basically, you do it on some insured reversionary bonuses and TBs, which in a previous session I showed you probably gives you a much smoother and easier profit pattern to actually manage with as well. And there's a timing of release stuff, but the key thing to my mind in handling all this is timing of recognition for shareholder profit is not an issue so long as it doesn't interfere with the underlying flow to policyholders. And you can get the correct flow to policyholders out of the process. And that's the challenge. You've got a question around expenses in the measurement, directly attributable in the words. There's a lot of detail around that, and I think ultimately there'll be a TRG question around what those words mean sooner or later. And to the extent you've got stuff that's outside for MOS purposes and to policyholder shareholder, you've got to recognise that your VFA ultimately takes the full share of the expenses that are under in that sharing process and handle that appropriately. So one way is just model the extra piece and differently and just identify that and then treat it appropriately as an 80-20 split is the thinking. Shareholder retained profits, we kind of dealt that. To my mind, I'm almost beginning to raise the question, I was beginning to think late in the process, it doesn't affect in the slightest. Do you actually need separate retained profits for the shareholder for this process to work? I get a gut feeling you probably really don't. Because effectively, that's just currently it's just a balancing item. Everybody sits at exactly 25% of the PRP, so it's just a mechanism of sharing investment income alignment. And then you've got the mutualisation via distribution. And it's now going to be very explicit. So effectively, when you do your modelling, you're going to have to get all your cash flows that go to the policyholders clearly, correctly identified. And so long as that part's done, the system with what's going to happen under Life Act, you should be able to, I think, make this work. Not to say that it ain't going to be very tricky to actually work through how you really operationalise it. Any comments on that? Questions? Everybody willing to put their hands up and say they think it kind of makes sense? A few do. A few people are brave. A lot of people want to take it on notice, I think. I can understand that.
Great diagram, friend.
It was yours, wasn't it? Chris said it was his. And then the other really fun piece is investment tax, which is now only being included for fiduciary. I think that's not an issue for your superannuation business or if you've got any power inside VPS SEAs, but for ordinary, I think it's really hard to make an argument that effectively that's tax paid on behalf of the policyholder that you otherwise would incur, which is kind of what IFRS 17 requires. So that's then going to end up, when you do your measurement of the CSM, generate a whole pile of extra shareholder parent profit, not real profit, because the tax isn't in the calculation. And you just have to back that out to get the right profit shares, because you can't take out, you want to take the right amount out to the pool. And that's important. And now, hand back
to, so yeah. Just before we move on to Chris, I guess, does anyone have any comments on the VFA? We actually did a beautiful worked example, and then determined that we could spend 2 hours just taking people through the worked example. So we haven't shown that to you, but essentially the view that we came to at the end of it is that you can probably, at least in a simple example, use it for 17 and have a handful of cash flow adjustments, which you know at the front what they are, so things like the tax or potentially expenses, and then keep track of it going forward that way. We probably need to have some more complex examples done just to make sure that will work under all scenarios. But does that sound reasonable to everyone? Is that sort of the direction that people are thinking of doing, or were they thinking they'd maintain current MOZ? Anyone disagree with this approach? Hands up. No? Anyone agree with it? Anyone's brain hurts and feels they needed to have more dessert?
Yeah, the other real challenge is even to do IFRS 17, you actually really have to know what the flows are to the policyholder.
Yep.
Just one comment, you know, with your shareholder profit aspect, I guess the question I didn't see whether you'd covered off is the aspect of the distribution of the profit. You know, I mean, the 80-20 acts as a constraint on the distribution, but I'm not sure I saw that in those aspects you outlined there.
I don't think it was. I'm just thinking, what's the purpose of that constraint? I think at the moment it's kind of to get alignment of the management of the policyholder funds in a shared fashion from the shareholder that takes serious account of the policyholder interests.
So essentially we're saying that there may be regulatory change required, but we went back to what are APRA's principles. And so we assumed that if we could come up with something that aligned with APRA's principles, then the regulatory change was a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I don't think there needs to be a regulatory change because the SRP is basically earned profit. It's just you can't distribute all of it. But it's basically been earned as far as AASB 17 is concerned. It's part of capital. It's part of retained earning.
Yep. That's a good... Yeah, Mark, that's a good question.
So in this approach, where does risk assessment sit? Does that sit in shareholder fund or both shareholder and policyholder fund?
So which sit?
Risk adjustment.
The risk adjustment under the IFRS 17 is only against the CSM. It's in the shareholder side. So there's only a risk adjustment on the cash flows to the shareholder. That's the way the model works. Oh, good, Peter. You've found the way out.
If I ask more questions, I stay awake. I was wondering, in the whole variable fee approach, whether the aspect of what bonuses you declare to the policyholders is altered, and how that might affect everything. So at the moment, we declare a bonus every year to the policyholders based on, you know, our MOZ liability, etc. I was wondering, in a variable fee approach, whether you would see a situation where your actual bonus declared is affected by your accounting, and therefore that does affect generations of policyholders and everything.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. So with those who are experienced in that area, who actually sets the bonus declarations off their MOZ supportable? I mean, my impression is I think it's set by an evolution from what the PRE perspective is rather than a profit accounting sense, really. It's my impression. I'm happy to be contradicted. Okay.
Thanks, Grant. As Grant alluded to earlier, AASB 17 introduces an additional complexity in that there are some contracts that span multiple funds that will need to be valued as a whole. So examples are an investment-linked contract with an insurance rider that sits in different stat funds, or in a friendly society context, you might have a contract that has different investment options which sits in different benefit funds. So to adopt AASB 17, APRA would need to think about how the apportionment would happen between of the liability between different funds. And I think they can think about it in two different contexts. They could mandate an approach, or they could say that it's on the companies to have an apportionment approach and then potentially be asking the appointed actuary to provide advice on whether that apportionment was appropriate or not. So the next two slides that I'll go through is just some suggested ideas for how that apportionment might work for a couple of different examples. So this first one's for the unit-linked contract with an insurance rider. So the best estimate cash flows, they're already separately identifiable. So it's the risk adjustment and the contractual service margin that we need to look at an apportionment for. So for the risk adjustment, a reasonable approach could be that that follows the risks that give rise to it. So for where it's largely related to the insurance rider part of it, then that's where the risk adjustment should be apportioned to. For the CSM, there's a couple of different approaches. One is that it could look at the calculation separately at inception, and then that drives how the contractual service margin would be apportioned between the two funds. That would be a simplified approach would be to let that carry forward for the remainder of the contract. You could do something more detailed where you actually reassess that apportionment as changes in assumptions or changes in future cash flows emerge over time. And another alternative is potentially to leverage the existing approach for the unit-linked part, so to basically set it as the policy liability equal to the account balance and have the remainder be in the insurance rider side. One thing probably to note as well on this is that if you are applying, say, the premium allocation approach where the risk adjustment and the CSM is implied, then effectively the apportionment becomes a lot simpler than if you've got the general approach. I might pause there. There's a few different things there. Is there any comments on those alternatives? Any questions about how it might work in practice? Yeah, sure.
Have you thought about what would happen in the unlikely event that you have an onerous contract under those scenarios?
So, I don't think the examples here would consider that. So obviously there would need to be some mechanism to apportion that benefit. So because you've effectively got a positive on one side and a negative that gives a smaller positive, so there may need to be a mechanism. Either it's all going to the positive component of the contract, or maybe there's some sharing whereby there could be a negative CSM potentially.
Yeah, I think with the sort of the third component, which is the one we liked, which was the policy liability mechanism, which is where you just put the account balance on the investment linked side as per now, and then put everything else into your non-investment linked fund. So essentially, any onerous component is therefore in that fund. I think we quite liked that on the basis of simplicity. And it then gets around all of those tricky decisions.
And it also carries forward things that people are already doing about accounting for the unit-linked contract as well.
Presumably the negative side, I mean, only the whole contract can be owned, it can't have one with
the other, like with the accounting. So this is just around APRA reporting. So from an IFRS 17 point of view, you have got one contract and that one contract is valued as a whole. This is then about saying, okay, I've calculated the policy liability for IFRS 17 or AASB 17 and I now need to do stat fund reporting. So how would I do that? And that was where we kind of thought, well, everybody is actually really comfortable with the investment linked component being the account balance. should we just stay with that and have that being the account balance, and then any difference then falls into the other statutory fund? And it could be that it actually arises from the investment linked component because the fees may not be enough to subsidise the expenses, but we decide not to think. We decide that we just make that decision. The alternative is you could do one of the other approaches, and yes, you may end up having with those a positive on one side and negative on the other, which balances out to be whatever it is, which I think is why we kept thinking, why don't we just go down the policy liability side and just split out the account balance, because it kind of avoids a lot of those questions. Did anybody have any views on that they had sort of a preference for one versus the other? Sort of the preference that we're going for is the KISS principle and keep it stupid simple kind of thing. But I think, as you've just identified, it doesn't necessarily mean that you've got sort of the accurate, you know, subcomponent of the policy liability in the relevant statutory fund.
And I think the important point on that is that's all around still impacting profit reporting, but from a solvency and capital perspective, the apportionment of CSM or risk adjustment between stat funds isn't going to impact the capital position of those funds separately. I'll move to the second example, which is looking at for friendly societies. So the example before, we might have a number of investment options that are in different funds and even the management fund as well, and how we're apportioning it. So it is common that the benefit fund rules may dictate in where basically that anything in the benefit fund is all for the policyholder. So in that case, where the CSM and the risk adjustment are a shareholder ideas, then they should all potentially be sitting in the management fund. That's one approach. And potentially you could, given that that is quite common for that structure to be there, you could say that that is the approach you might take for everything, unless there's a view that it might give a materially distorted result to what the underlying economics is. The other thought process is, again, around the risk adjustment potentially following where the capital is being held in respect to those the risks underlying it, so related to insurance decrements, etc., follow where the capital is held is where the risk adjustment is held for accounting. I think the key thing across all of this, more to the point, is that the overall policy liability is staying the same. All that we're doing here is just mandating an approach to apportion that between funds. So, and to do it, to try and do that in a way that's not going to increase significantly the amount of work that's required, given that it's not impacting the solvency of the funds concerned.
So we've just sort of picked two examples to give you an idea of the potential sort of complexity that's involved here. What we're interested in is kind of your view on, is this something whereby there should just be a rule, assuming that APRA says yes, we'll just go to AASB 17, should they then issue a set of rules as to how it should be apportioned between statutory funds or benefit funds, etc.? Should it be left to the actuary's discretion? Should it be a guidance? Should it be guide? This is how we would suggest you do it, subject to actuarial guidance. Is it something where the institute should actually put forward a guidance note or an information note on it? Where do we as an industry sort of think that this sort of division between the statutory funds, how that should work? Any views?
I have a view, but I no longer work at APRA, so...
You can have an ex-APRA view, David.
Well, I would think that if it's a regulatory requirement, then APRA should set the rules. And everybody should do it. Rather than... Because if you leave it up to the actuary, then every single company would do something different, potentially.
Any disagreement with that?
Very simple.
Well, I think that's why we were sort of trying to come up with this, I guess, in advance of APRA coming up with anything, so that we could potentially be suggesting solutions which are straightforward but we think meet the need. Any other views? Sorry.
I guess just one comment. You know, we've seen examples of if you have something rigid, then almost the first example that you come to doesn't quite fit. So I'd just make, you know, the potential for keeping it simple by something definite, but a mechanism to deal with exceptions, which will probably be the first case you come to. Murphy's Law.
I think that was sort of the approach the task force was going, not task force, the three of us were going down in terms of thinking that it would be good for APRA to sort of say, well, this is our preferred approach, but if you need to differ from it, you can, but then you need to state in your FCR or whatever why you have done so and justify it.
So we've talked about VFA. We've talked about contracts that span multiple funds, which are areas that APRA will need to look at in terms of requirements for AASB 17. This slide summarises a few other areas that have changes in profit reporting that we've considered and that could result in potential differences between the way that companies report their profit result. So, for example, the size of the risk adjustment depending on what the confidence level of how the organisation set that, whether they use other comprehensive income or not. In our view, none of the items on there impact the insolvency position of the entity, which is the key concern from an APRA perspective. So it would probably seem more simpler to not introduce any more additional complexity to the reporting than what's required in that case.
So I think we kind of had one of our objectives at the start as being consistency, and we left it on there. But then when we actually got to kind of considering consistency, the level of additional calculation required to say that everybody then does their calculations with, I know, a 75% confidence interval as well so that you can get that consistency. We thought, well, what actually is the real purpose of that or how important is it? So I'm interested if anyone has views on whether there should be some form of consistency so that, you know, for APRA purposes, we would do it in a more aligned manner and what the value or benefit from that consistency is. So, for example, at the moment, APRA now says that for its reporting for general insurance, you have to do it at a minimum of 75% confidence interval, but you don't need to do that for your financial reporting. Would we be accepting that APRA may do something similar? And if so, what is the justification for a regulatory perspective of them doing so? Any views? Does that mean does anyone see a strong need for consistency as being an objective, I guess? Can the nice person who's nodding over there?
I guess in my view, it's really, this is for capital reporting, so we need a strong kind of guidance from the regulators who, you know, have that mindset. So if it's for internal risk management, I think that's a different kind of conversation. But for statutory reporting, yeah, I would say consistency is still quite a key.
So if I can challenge you to kind of think of your APRA reporting in two buckets, one of which is you report a P&L, which has no impact upon your solvency at all, and the other one of which is you report all your capital reporting. So what we were thinking is, in terms of the things that impact your P&L, such as whether you choose to put your change in discount rates through P&L or through other comprehensive income, what risk adjustment you choose for your policy liability, things like that, they impact your profit emergence, but they don't actually impact your P&L, your balance sheet from a capital point of view. And I think that's what you're going to talk about next, is it?
Yeah, in two slides' time. Yeah,
right.
I will.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'll cover that off. I'll talk about reinsurance. First, reinsurance is an area of AASB 17 where there's significant change to what we're doing at the moment, and I'd say still quite a bit of discussion around what will how that will be accounted for under AASB 17. So examples are that the reinsurance contract, for example, is separated from the underlying insurance contract, which is including potentially having a contract boundary that's different to the underlying insurance contracts. And also there's no offset to underlying losses if the underlying insurance contract is in loss recognition at outset. Nonetheless, given all of the changes that are there, there's no solvency implications from having these differences to the way that we're accounting under MOS at the moment. And given that each company will need to account for their reinsurance contracts under the new standard, we think it's appropriate to align to that and not to try and add any undue complexity, so not suggesting any changes from a reinsurance perspective. And then what everyone's been waiting for, capital. So under AASB 17, I think it's likely that for a lot of life insurers, the starting balance sheet is going to be weaker than what it is under MOS reporting at the moment. So there's things like the risk adjustment that's being added. There's potentially doing onerousness testing at a lower granularity. But none of that will actually impact the end capital position of the business. So the first step that's involved in the capital calculation is to restate the assets and liabilities on the balance sheet to their versions for the capital calculations in the capital base. So the policy liability, whatever you have, is replaced by an adjusted policy liability in the capital standards. So from that perspective, the new accounting standards on its own doesn't have an impact on the solvency of the entity. So that should, we think, is an important point that means that APRA should be less worried from a regulatory perspective of the accounting standard changes. There will be wording changes that will likely be required to the capital standards, but that'll be mainly because there's areas where they're at the moment referring to terms that are defined in LPS 340, the valuation standard, etc. But not expecting that there would need to be any changes to the level of capital that are being held. Any comments or questions on that? Because I think that is an important point to understand. So there will be a secondary impact from the realisation of tax. So if we move to a world where the APRA is adopting AASB 17, then tax obviously follows that as a policy liability basis at the moment. So as tax potentially gets realised, then that would have a secondary impact on the capital position. So in conclusion, we don't see that there's any impediment to APRA adopting AASB 17 for regulatory profit reporting. We've talked about some additional tracking that life insurers will need to do in addition to what's the AASB 17 accounting requirements so that they still continue to satisfy Life Act requirements. There'll also be apportionment to consider for where there's contracts that sit across multiple funds. But a key point from it is that there would be no impact to starting balance sheet positions of solvency for the insurers. I think one thing to think about, and further to Brian's comments as well, is as an industry, as a profession, what role do we have to play in trying to help APRA through the education process to give them some views about what changes they could make to limit the reporting burden on insurers. So people have any thoughts on that, then feel free to come to the mic, or if you've got any other questions.
So at the moment, the IFRA 17 task force of the Actuaries Institute has largely been an educational task force that has sort of produced some information to help members understand the new accounting standard. It hasn't actually been involved in any lobbying activity to date. Would it be appropriate for that task force or a subcomponent of that task force to actually put together a more detailed sort of analysis of the sort of things that we've been through today to present to APRA to say, look, on our basis now, understanding this is how you would deal with AASB 17 to sort of help them get to where they need to be sooner rather than later, with the benefit of sort of the institute resources supporting them on that. Views? All in favour? Anyone disagree? Anyone think that there's any sort of other actions that should be taken forward in order to sort of help APRA get to a commercially good outcome, which also meets their objectives?
I guess just a comment. You know, we've had a history of APRA being heavily involved in financial reporting. So, to my mind, sort of a first step is getting over that hurdle of, you know, the view that we're sort of arriving at is that they vacate the field to some extent. Mm-hmm. So I think it's that argument or that discussion, you know, as well as all the technical working through it, just that in principle rationale for, as I've described it, vacating the field. So I see that as part of the process that would need to be worked through, but I'd be interested in comments.
From my perspective, I think you're absolutely right, and that's sort of why we had that landscape field at the start to sort of explain why APRA, in our understanding, has been involved to date, which is due to the fact that it was all developed before the accounting standards were, and when the accounting standard came out, there wasn't an insurance contract standard, so there's nothing in AASB 1038. And so APRA filled a void, and that void no longer exists. So that was our views. Are there sort of other views as to why APRA might have a financial reporting, you know, role? So we've kind of said their role is capital. Currently, they would view that they have a role which is sort of the P&L and capital. So we're saying, no, not on the P&L.
I would think that APRA might see, I take your point about them vacating the field as far as reporting on the P&L is concerned, but they might want still to have some level of reporting in relation to what goes into the calculation of capital.
I agree, they may do. Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us on our journey in APRA's shoes today, and we'll probably take this forward and have a discussion with the Institute Task Force about it.
Can you please, well, you've started already, can you please thank Brown and Grant and Chris in the usual way? Thank you.